morning. As I think most of you know, I'm David Johnson, the President and CEO of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership and Crossroads. Welcome to all of you here on this spectacular day. It's a good thing we have your seats turned toward me instead of toward the window, because it'd be hard to pay attention otherwise. I want to thank Miles Printing for sponsoring us here again today. Do wonderful things with them, and they've been a great sponsor for this entire series. And this is the, Lori, this is our third Frameworks this year, but this is the second one we've had on this topic of clinical innovation and physician innovators. And that's a critical topic for us. We have, for many reasons, been interested in the convergence of healthcare and life sciences from the very beginning about Crossroads. Increasingly, too, in the world of devices and diagnostic products, it is medical innovation, clinical innovation, that really drives all innovation for the development of these companies. Our work with our counterparts at OrthoWorks up in the orthopedic capital of the world in Warsaw, our colleagues at Cook, our friends at Roche, underscores every day the importance of the practice of medicine to the delivery of greater innovation and better patient care. The founding chairman of BioCrossroads, Dr. Gus Watanabe, was sort of a guy that did it all. He was obviously a very successful entrepreneur in the latter part of his career. He was an unbelievably successful head of Lilly Research Labs and presided over the Lilly Research Enterprise in the days when Lilly stock was $100 a share. That was a pretty nice time to be heading Lilly Research Labs. But prior to that, he was also, as most of you know, the chairman of the Department of Medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine, and certainly had distinguished careers in all of those areas. It was interesting working with Gus for many reasons, but it was interesting working with Gus later in the BioCrossroads experience when we started to look at medical innovation and new products, because he never forgot that he was a physician looking at new ideas. And so he would ask, in addition to the questions that we would ask about, is this product likely to be successful? Is it going to really solve an unmet patient need? Is there a possibility for getting it through the FDA? Do you have an experienced management team to try to lead it forward? Those were all pertinent questions for him. But I remember one time in particular, he turned to someone who actually was an orthopedic surgeon and said, "Do you think this product really represents good medicine?" And that's a really interesting thing about physician innovators, because they are vocationally called to be good physicians as well as innovative practitioners. And so they always have to keep the patient and the patient's needs in mind. That leads, as we know from the last one of these sessions, to really complex issues of conflicts of interest, sort of how is that dealt with when you're dealing with human subjects who are also human patients who are under the care of physicians oftentimes who are doing the innovation. How does intellectual property get recognized and perfected? How really does this research engine move ahead when it's being driven by practicing physicians? And that's really the topic for today. I think last time, the first of these sessions, talked a great deal about the conflict of interest issues, which are not going to get resolved in one or ten framework sessions, but they are important to get on the table and out in front of us. I think today's session we're going to talk a little bit more about why all this matters and what the clinically driven research engine looks like when it's in practice, even though these issues of conflicts and property protection never go away and sort of guide that practice. So to begin our program today, and this is a great program for us, we have a group of friends who are going to be speaking with you here today. Dr. McIntosh from Cook, our friend Dr. Anantha Shekhar, who we work with in all sorts of things, but who leads the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, and our colleague Laura Lyons, who works with SonarMed, and we're looking at Nora Doherty here too. SonarMed is our very first BioCrossroads seed fund investment. It is a startup that we invested in, about 9 years ago now at this point, and has had a very successful track record, very successful introduction of products into the market, and Laura has everything to do with this ongoing success of that company, so we're just delighted to have her here today. We really are proud of what SonarMed is doing. To get you started, though, I want to introduce Dr. Michael Behrend, who is helped design many hip and knee and partial knee implant systems. He's a thought leader in total joint replacement research. He has trained over 3,000 surgeons in the latest surgical techniques of partial knee replacements, and has recently launched his own enterprise, the Midwest Center for Joint Replacement and the Midwest Specialty Center, focused on outpatient joint replacement care. He's developed many of the protocols used in this area, and is really a world leader in this type of practice and also in this type of innovation. And we're delighted to have him start the discussion today, and then the others will participate, and eventually Dr. Shekhar will moderate a panel, and you'll be able to hear from all of them. So, Dr. Barron, welcome.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting me. This is certainly a different environment for an orthopedic surgeon. I will show a video of the inside of the knee just to make me feel a little more comfortable, and maybe perhaps you won't feel quite as comfortable. But it is interesting to think about all the things that were discussed in that introduction. They affect every patient that I see, every patient that I operate on, every implant that we design and then decide that may be best for you, or a different implant may be best for you. And how do we manage that space of doctor-patient interaction? How do we do it ethically, safely, and manage that conflict of interest? So I just want to take you through my career in this space over the last 20 years and hopefully have a good discussion afterwards. So all of our talks, we begin with the disclosure slide. This is something mandated at all of our societies now. And so this is my disclosure of a number of things: research funding, both basic science and clinical support. We have many intellectual property agreements, things we've developed, things we've co-developed with industry, and then consulting arrangements with these orthopedic manufacturers. We receive research funding from our hospital. We've received grants from the National Science Foundation. We've developed some software technology with different people, and it all applies to things we're learning about improving outcomes in orthopedic surgery. Part of the materials that were distributed had an interesting hypothesis that I thought scrutiny on physician-industry relationships are handicapping innovation in translational medicine and marring the current healthcare environment. And I certainly affirm that hypothesis. The scrutiny that's been on me and our enterprise has been at times helpful, at times toxic, and I just want to run you through what that scrutiny looks like and perhaps how we could do it a little bit better. So you'll hear many times, we heard in the last frameworks that I was honored to attend, how does patient care improve and how does it translate to patients and improve outcomes? And I think there's a number of things here that, be it ideas from industry, ideas from surgeons, ideas from nurses, that lead to data collection, that lead to clinical trials, that lead to things we can study in our laboratory, that lead to educational programs, that once we learn something, how do we teach other surgeons how to do that? Because once you leave your training, there's not really good avenues for additional development of new skills, of new understanding, and I think that's a place that we really need to focus on surgeon education. So patient care improves through all of these things working together, and I think through some of the ideas that you all are working on. One premise that I would put out there for you is that I think there are value for experienced clinical providers, whether it's Dr. Watanabe or our orthopedic center, that 35 years of experience and 35,000 joint replacements leads to some tribal knowledge that has value, both in terms of intellectual property, in terms of education, and certainly in terms of economics for both us and for industry and for Indiana and for all of your companies. Our little small practice of orthopedic surgeons has the largest clinical database in the state. Almost 40,000 patients are now enrolled. This is a privately funded 501c3 research foundation. We then take that data, publish various peer-reviewed articles. We present at both regional, national, and international conferences on our findings. And then we teach other surgeons how to do what we've learned. It's sort of teach a man to fish type concept. And we're focused on clinical outcomes, and now we've switched into cost reduction maneuvers, earlier return to function, earlier return to work, and I think a lot of things that Hoosiers and employers are extremely interested in. We've been recognized based on this experience and, I guess, our outcomes and our thought leading in this space. to be recognized by our peers as leaders in this field. And I think it gives us a voice for appropriate innovation, and with the right management of the physician-industry relationship, I think we do bring value to our patients and to the world. So a number of ways that we've been able to do this, through basic science research, I'll share some of that with you, through clinical research, some is that we've done on our own, some is funded in IDE trials or other type of pathways. We then have a number of intellectual property transfer arrangements. We do some consulting, that's a small piece of what we do, and then we do some independent IP development and sale to industry. So our basic science pathway is through a laboratory at Rose Holman. One of our master's thesis students became an employee from us at Rose Holman, and we've studied a number of things related to hip and knee implant science. There's a lot of work done on the implant side alone, and we've taken a whole path of research looking at the interaction of the implant with the bone and how we can improve that interaction for a more durable implant, studied failure mechanisms of various knee and hip implants, and this is some of the work that we've taken windmill technology and applied it. We've taken automotive technology and engineering principles and applied those to orthopedic surgery. So we're sort of marrying a number of the engineering technologies in our laboratory. We can create very colorful and enjoyable graphs with our computers, and this is all funded by the National Science Foundation. So small seed funding has led to larger grants for us, and it's led to all kinds of downstream publications. Studying the interaction of how far you cut the bone in a knee replacement, what changes with the shape of the bone when you go further down into the tibia or the shin bone, and then what's the interaction? The colors represent stresses in the bone, and we think there's an ideal stress pattern that can be achieved with a knee implant, and we've really been able to use different technologies to examine that. This is, if you look at the shape of a smaller femoral component on the top, the 60-millimeter one, compared to a bigger one. It's never been investigated what the interaction of a big femur on a small tibia is for the body. So we were able to investigate that. It's led to different implant design changes, and we think in the long run, better clinical outcomes. Our first study a number of years ago, what happens if we don't put it in very well? The number one error leading to revision of a knee replacement is the archer, not the arrow. So we are hesitant to admit that publicly, but I think that's true and borne out in many different studies. So we studied that in our laboratory. This is a photoelastic coating technology from the automotive industry that you use polarized light, or like wearing sunglasses where you turn it in your car and you can't read your radio dial. We use that same principle to study the strain pattern in the top of the tibia. And then we've been able to determine that if you put it in straight, it's a healthier biological environment for the tibia. So it is a translational experience, I guess, in our laboratory, both for the students, for us, for clinical discovery, and then ultimately for implant science and what we've done. So we hear a lot about conflict of interest, and I think if we're able to manage it appropriately, a number of great things happen. And so for our laboratory, over the last 10 years, what fruit has come from that? We've had 17 journal publications, presented our work on 37 projects. We've increased our funding to almost $1 million from a $5,000 seed grant from me and from one of my patients from Detroit. He was on the 4GT project a number of years ago. We did his knee replacements, got talking about Rose Holman, and then this is the fruit that came from that seed. It's been fun to see 42 undergraduate students come through our program. 12 students have gotten their master's theses, and it's really grown into a great clinical combined with basic science program to help educate folks. A number of the people are still enrolled in various graduate programs, and then we've been able to take a number of our students and plug them into your companies throughout Indiana. So I think this is working, this conflict of interest. Yes, we receive research funding. I received no personal funding for this, unfortunately, but we are taking those dollars and translating them into educated and trained folks that understand orthopedic science, understand engineering, and now are plugged into many of your companies. So here's this concept of putting it in straight. There's new technology. This is an accelerometer, which is what you use in your iPhone to turn the screen, the same type of technology. we can use to align a knee replacement. So this is the inside of a knee where we're using that box. It has an accelerometer in it, and it links to this navigation system, and we can specifically dial in the alignment of the knee replacement. So we know that malalignment is a problem, and then we can use simple technology. So there we're drilling something in. There's, oh yeah, so that's, how you guys doing? Is that all right? All right, good. So we use this technology to look at it in three planes. So initially this company developed this device to look at it in the X and the Y plane. We developed some IP to do it in the Z plane. So rotation, tilt, and slope of the knee replacement are all very, very important. So this is an example of basic science research, clinical research, innovative technology, IP licensing, and then better for patient care. And it also is very cool to use this during the operation. It's far more accurate than us just giving it the Kentucky windage that we usually do. What about patient safety? You're hearing all about this with Obamacare initiatives, patient safety and quality outcome reporting measures. This is all a little bit of, I think, bogus language that's coming from Washington. But patient safety, from our clinical research, we've decided to investigate whether a partial knee replacement is safer than a total knee replacement. Half of our practice now is partial knee replacement surgery. The national average is about 6% of knees are partial knees. In our practice, it's 50%. And so we think perhaps a partial knee is safer than having to do an entire knee replacement. If we can recognize the patients better, learn how to do the operations well, would it be a safer operation? So we took a multi-center study, three large knee replacement centers around the world, combined all the data, and either were not very good total knee replacement surgeons, which certainly could be the case, or partial knee replacements are threefold safer than a total knee replacement. So this is an example of patient safety concerns being addressed through the appropriate amount of surgery for each patient. Patient satisfaction, obviously there's a couple ways to see how satisfied you are. As physicians, we can say, you're doing okay, aren't you? And then we're back out the door. Or really, how are you doing? How are you functioning? What can you do? What can't you do? Did we give you your quality of life back? And so we really began to look at patient satisfaction in terms of outcomes. So we did a multi-center study, again, looking at total knees and then two types of partial knees, where we leave the two-thirds of the normal part of the knee alone. And we asked the patients through an independent survey center at the University of Wisconsin how they would report their outcomes. In other words, when we report them, there's some bias in, you're doing okay, aren't you? Yeah, yeah, you're really, you know, how are you doing on the stairs? You don't use a railing that much, do you? Just occasionally? Only going down? And so it's funny, when you ask the patients when we're not around, the results are a little bit different. So again, partial knee replacements, twofold better than a total knee replacement for performing activities of daily living, and almost threefold more likely to say their knee felt normal. It's a little bit unfair because you keep two-thirds of your own knee if you get a partial knee replacement, so of course you're going to feel better. But this is the first time patient satisfaction has been analyzed. All of our basic science and clinical research we publish as the journals will let us. We always think it's great. They sometimes don't. And peer-reviewed publication is a means of dissemination of information, as you're well aware. Some of these ideas we have about improving patient care do result in patent applications or other intellectual property licensing arrangements. This is a collaborative of three surgeons and three engineers that resulted in using MRI technology to align knee implants and now hip implants, and it's a very interesting space that we were able to work with Biomet on this. So this is an example of personal, academic, sort of private practice, idea generation leading to patents and then new technology. The biggest thing in the last 3 years for us has been outpatient joint replacement surgery. So everything we've learned from anesthesia, implant science, what you do and don't need to do in caring for a joint replacement patient, how to control the pain after the operation so you can function earlier, less invasive surgical techniques, better blood management, all the things that we've learned in pieces, we've been able to assimilate those and move basically 50% of our practice to the outpatient environment. So the average length of stay now for a partial knee replacement is 129 minutes, and for a total joint or a total hip or total knee replacement, it's under 6 hours. So what used to be, and I'll show you some time data, what used to be a 2 or 3 week experience, we've been now able to shrink down to a 1 day experience. And so this is a knee replacement from roughly 2001. And you can say I'm sort of holding this Jimongo incision. This is a very skinny patient that we've really done a huge operation on their knee to where now we can do it through a 2-inch incision and you're home for dinner that day. So that type of progress in Indiana, of all the states in the U.S., Indiana is the best place to be in this space producing clinical centers that focus on this. I think medicine for us now is incredibly dynamic. The oversight associated with Obamacare, the concept of meaningful use, have you heard this term related to computers and doctor's offices? So the government has now controlled the language we're using in terms of using technology with the patient interaction. So you can't just use the electronic medical record. You have to use it in a meaningful way, which is not defined by me or by the patient, but an outside person that I think the time stamp for you to now see someone in the office, there's an extra 20 minutes of nonsense that don't need to be done in order to comply with these regulatory rules. So Obamacare in and of itself to provide coverage for folks is wonderful. The back end thing that you may not see that we have no voice in regulating is all this backdoor regulatory stuff that's become an incredible burden for us, independent of the economics of doing it. The time footprint and loss of doctor-patient relationship is a huge problem. So this is the 25-year history of joint replacements. You used to stay in the hospital. I've done some studies from the 70s where folks stayed 3 weeks after a joint replacement, and now we're down to 3 hours. It's been an amazing transformation. But you can see it's undergone various different phases to where now, 2013 and forward, I think the cost savings associated with this are 30 to 40% of the total bucket to do the operation. And I think this is the space where things are going to go in the future. Indiana, again, is not a certificate of need state. If you're familiar with that language, that means if you want to build a surgical center, you can do that without getting approval from the state certificate of need police or insurance regulator, hospital, militia, whatever you want to call them. That was a little biased, but that's true. Certain states have certificate of needs where you cannot do this. In certain states, I think Indiana is much more innovative. The group we work with is Surge Center Development, and they now have 12 centers around Indiana that are performing thousands of these procedures on an outpatient basis. So little did I know living in Indianapolis and Indiana would have the environment for translational medicine, clinical research, basic science research, and now center development. It's just been absolutely wonderful. So a little bit about the scrutiny I've enjoyed over the last few decades. Our friends at the IBJ were able to talk about our relationships with the hospitals. So there's nothing like your compensation appearing on the front page of the IBJ where my friends are emailing me, hey, nice, good job, you know. And I'm not sure this scrutiny accurately reflects the work that we're doing. That's the critique that I would have. The number in and of itself doesn't reflect whether I've done one operation, 500 operations, 1,000 well, 10 poorly, the level of sophistication or anything. So I think anytime you see these numbers and the scrutiny is on the providers, from a provider perspective, I'm happy for anyone to know the compensation, but I would love for you to know the work done to earn that compensation for the value we've brought to those patients for what we're doing. So it's the scrutiny is fine. It tends to stop at the number, and I think that's a little bit unfortunate. A number of years ago, our friend Chris Christie had a chance to investigate my relationship with orthopedic industry, and this was somewhere between colonoscopy and a rectal exam for me when the Department of Justice comes by and says, hey, we'd like to talk to you about prosecuting your friends and your relationship with that. What an experience. And, you know, you look at words like prosecution, hip and knee replacement industry, being one of the lead developers with Biomet and other people. They reported all of our payments from industry on their website, which is fine, but they would not allow the publication of the work done, patents, implants designed, 1,800 hip and knee codes, that we've developed implants for, publications, paid research. It was only the number, much like the newspaper is only the number. There's no work behind what is done, so it doesn't differentiate or scrutinize between people that are really doing work and people that are getting paid and not doing any work. So I think the scrutiny needs to go all the way and do both of those things. Indianapolis Star, they called me and asked for a comment. I've never been asked for a comment before, so I prepared a statement. It's the first time I've ever prepared a statement, and I turned in my statement, and they published it. So you can look back. It's only on microfilm now. I tried to get a copy of it from, I thought that was interesting, from 2007. We're all the way back to microfilm. It's at the library over here if you want to get it. So the title was Federal Prosecutors Call Them Bribes and Kickbacks, Orthopedic Surgeons Call Them Legitimate Consulting Fees for Their Hard Work. Obviously, I prefer the latter part of that. The interesting thing is after this investigation, the money that I received for consulting went up threefold. So after the DOJ came in and said, this thing is, we're going to blow this up and investigate and take your computer and look at all your IP arrangements, all the product codes, it was all proved legitimate. The dollars paid to me went up threefold based on their mandate. But that never came out. No one ever saw the result of the investigation. Everything was released. But it's just very, very interesting how we'll publish the numbers, but we won't publish the results. We won't publish the numbers, but we won't publish the information and the work done. So we're now into transparency in the Sunshine Act. You may have heard of this coming out with Obamacare. So it's three easy steps, which I've tried three different times over multiple hours to sign in and even look at my own thing to validate it. It can't be done. I have not been able to successfully get in and see what is being reported on my relationship with any industry. So for you to get in there and look and somehow make a judgment about me as a surgeon, I think it's impossible. And again, on this, it does not say what work has been done. It doesn't say the publications. It only says the number. It doesn't present all the information. So I think this is limiting your perspective and understanding on relationship with physician industry. So I think the sun is still a bit shaded on this space. I would love for it to say the number and all the work that's been done. So how do we manage this so-called conflict, which I think is real? Every one of our patients, we have signed a consent form, talks about, you know, your leg could be backwards and your foot wouldn't work and all this infection and all this. And then at the end, we talk about our relationship with industry. And we disclose everything that's going on with the implants we've developed. We have in bold, this has helped advance implant science. Surgeons don't receive any payment for implants put in you. We're not paid to put any implant into a patient. And we want them to understand that. We love when people ask us about it. We bring out all the publications and all the work we're doing to help them see what we're doing. And then we have them sign this as part of their consent form. So we don't know how we could disclose this anymore to our patients. We would love to manage it well. We'd love for them to know what we're doing. And this is an example. So the end result, whether it's the laboratory, clinical research, training other people, publishing, developing centers, saving money in terms of overall cost of joint replacement, this is the bottom line, is people helping people. And so the innovation column of our three visions that we're shooting for, compassion, innovation, and reverence, the innovation piece I think is critical. We've been able to help thousands of patients through our program, and it's a real treat to be doing that at this time. So I look forward to the discussion, and obviously I've presented a very biased perspective on this, which I welcome any critique of that. And I think Da Vinci has some things to teach us from 500 years ago. It says, the painter who has no doubt about his own ability will attain very little. When his work succeeds beyond his judgment, the artist acquires nothing. But when his judgment is superior to his work, he will never cease to improve unless his love of gain interferes and retards his progress. So I think that certainly applies to our innovation in the orthopedic space. Thank you very much for that. So I'd like to introduce Dr. McIntosh from Cook. He has a far more diverse career, from hemostasis to cardiac surgery, time with the NIH, and now with Cook Industries. So as chief medical officer, I think he has a unique perspective on some of the things I've talked about. Dr. McIntosh.
Important question. Which button do I push to advance it?
innovation.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of this program for the invitation. I guess we have Washington, D.C., and all the premature things going on with presidential hopefuls, so it's nice to be here. I'd like to give you my perspective from over 25 years at the NIH in terms of product development. We did some of the early work, as I'll show you, on heart valve development, as well as artificial lungs, and then having worked with the FDA on the circulatory systems panel for 10 years, it's been an interesting lifetime. And some people say, well, how do you do all these things? I said, see, you just live long enough. So, I'd like to start out with some of the information I have in optimizing patient care through continuing innovation, the importance of collaboration of industry and the inventor. And it's just as if the industry has been the bad guys. I'll assure you that this has been going on for a long time. This is my disclosure. I am a full-time Cook Medical employee. This is a display that was put together at the NIH to sort of earmark the 50 years of collaboration that's has been going on between industry and the NIH. In the early days of cardiac surgery, we didn't really have good heart valves. We didn't have all of the engineering information we needed to show that a device was at least safe before it started being implanted in humans. But this is a panel that this display now stands just outside the doors of the library at NIH. It's a three-sided panel, 15 feet on each side and 10 feet high. So we're going back historically and looking at this. And this shows President Johnson, who came to the NIH to sign legislation to increase our research budget, what we were always thankful for. Now they don't come there. They just say we're reducing it. But I think this says a lot of things. First of all, as Cook has said for the last 50 years, as the NIH said back then, it's all about the patients. And we sort of had the extremes in terms of patients. This is a young man that had a heart valve replacement. He was from Greece. The physician on the right over there is Don Frederickson, who became the director of NIH. And the other gentleman in the white coat was Glenn Morrill, who was my mentor and who trained me as a cardiac surgeon. And President Johnson was talking to this young man, and all of a sudden he turned to Glenn Morrill and he said, Dr. Morrill, I'd like to listen to this young man's heart. Can I borrow your stethoscope? Well, what the president didn't know was the day before, the Secret Service detail had come out to the NIH, as they always do, and they told us that in no certain circumstances were we to give the President of the United States our stethoscope. So the first thing that LBJ said was, Dr. Morrill, can I use your stethoscope? And Glenn just kind of stood there like a deer in the headlights. And finally he said, Dr. Morrill, I'd like to listen to this young man's heart. So Glenn said, Mr. President, I was told under no circumstances was I to give you my stethoscope. And LBJ looked at him and he said, who told you that? He said, your Secret Service. He looked back at Glenn and he said, Dr. Morrill, who's the commander-in-chief of this country? Glenn said, I understand that. Takes a stethoscope out and hand it to him. So this is a big event. I forgot what the increase in the NIH budget was at that time, but President Johnson is very pro of research, medical research. And he did get to listen to the young man's heart. This is a open heart operation at the NIH for prosthetic heart valve replacement in the early 1970s. We had two of the most incredible operating rooms of anybody in the country at that time that we could actually do hemodynamic studies in the operating room to make sure we had achieved what we wanted to, either with a new heart valve or with a congenital operation or with some type of acquired. This was operating room one, and that was me when I was a very young man. This is another shot of that operating room. There were two operating rooms that had a central facility up here for recording research data and monitoring the patient. The induction room was over on this side, so when the patient was brought in to be put to sleep, we didn't have all the traffic in the operating room, which I think minimized a lot of the infections that we didn't have. And we had a duplicate operating room, this on the other side, the central supply was over here, but it was a very futuristic operating room. And one of the most clever things was that all these lights up here that went around were tractor headlights. And the reason that we used tractor headlights is it didn't throw any beams. There was no cross-hatching as the seal beam does. So we had all the lights focused on the center of the heart of the patient right here. And this ether screen, Dr. Moore, I should say, you know, this side of the ether screen is hours of boredom and moments of terror. On this side of the ether screen, it's hours of terror and moments of boredom. So he told the anesthesiologist to stay on this side of the screen of it. But it was a very unique environment for a cardiac operating room at that time. And the only reason I'm saying this, we didn't have all the studies that FDA would have required for heart valve development. So we did a lot of hemodynamic studies and other things in the operating room here to show that what we had done with the prosthesis was indeed efficacious for the patient. And a lot of those data were actually presented to the FDA. And this, until mid-1970s, the FDA was not in the picture. So early collaboration, this shows a number of the different heart valves that came along. We had a display in the operating room that probably had 50 different devices from all over the world. Of those 50, maybe three or four of the heart valves actually ended up working. The rest of them are oftentimes very prone to thrombosis, emergency operations for patients. But one of them that the NIH was involved with was the development of the Hancock-Reese valve, which is here. And this is one of the first bioprostheses that actually worked. The prior ones were all cross-linked with formaldehyde, and they broke down very quickly. This was cross-linked with glutaraldehyde and increased longevity tremendously. The other heart valve that became the workhorse for us was a Stargardt's ball valve, which is a silicone ball inside of a cage. And it was interesting, one of the things that we didn't have the benefit of with a lot of the pre-IDE testing and so forth was we had no idea how to cure, or Stargardt's laboratory had no idea how to cure the silicone. And we found out that a number of patients were coming back, particularly with that valve in the aortic position, and it was stuck. It had adsorbed lipids from the circulation and had formed pockets of liquefied silicone and swollen and actually was stuck on the tracks and moving up and down in a very precise fashion. But on occasion, it would get stuck. I had one patient who came in. He had seven different episodes of fainting after this was implanted. And every time he'd fall to the ground, he'd wake up again. Well, at the time of operation, the ball was so swollen that it would actually pop out of the cage. I'm sorry, it had been eroded. It would pop out of the cage and get stuck between the three struts and the aortic cage. And when he crawled back to the ground, it would knock the ball back into the cage and start working again properly. So I was part of a team with bioengineers that formed a study. We could tell when this valve was becoming either too enlarged or too small. But this is some of the early work that was done at the NIH prior to the FDA. The other area that was of great interest to us there was the development of the collable spiral artificial lung, which has been used and still is used for ECMO. This is Ted Collable up there. That shows the spiral lung, and the thing that was so different about this than the normal lung, heart lung, that we use in a heart lung machine, was you could use on a patient for days and days and days, and there'd be no hemolysis of the blood. If we use our regular heart-lung machine, whether it's our Olsen device that we had or one of the other ones, we would have hemolysis to a significant amount. So this is some of the work that was done prior to the FDA, and we treated a number of patients at the NIH with the collable lung. So these are all things that came along before the FDA and CMS. Now here we are in the 21st century, development of medical devices. And these partnerships between industry and inventors now, I think, are even more important because of the FDA approval process, the CMS role in reimbursement, and codes for reimbursement. It's very simple. No FDA approval, no U.S. commercial distribution. No reimbursement, no products available for patient care unless the patient pays for it himself. And very few patients can afford to do that. And possible to obtain a CE mark for use in patients outside the United States, but that doesn't help the patients in the United States. So I think it's very important now to realize how important this collaboration is between the inventors, innovators, and industry. So consideration for bringing new medical devices to patients, first thing is to identify the appropriate patients to be treated. And I'll touch on this in just a moment. And my suggestion has always been, suggest writing the label for the intended use of the patient population to be treated early in the process. Inventors don't like to do that. They know they're going to cure every disease known to man, and they wait to see what they're going to put on the label. And consequently, you miss out on a great opportunity of designing your clinical studies, your animal studies, to be able to show early on that this development or this device is going to be appropriate for the patient. Establish the FDA regulatory pathway, which may include combination products. That strikes the fear and hearts of people that have to deal with this. An example of this is drug-coated stents to treat CAD or peripheral arterial disease. Cook happens to have a paclitaxel-coated stent. And I can't tell you what an arduous project that was, trying to get that approved by the FDA, going between the Center for Device Evaluation and for Drug. And they don't necessarily speak to each other during this whole process. But it's important, I think, to look at your label and say, okay, how are we going to design the pre-investigation device studies to be performed to obtain FDA approval for an IDE PMA? This applies to drugs, biologics as well. But I'm more into devices, so that's why I've sort of stuck with this. And you have to design the appropriate clinical trial study to support safety and effectiveness endpoints for the FDA approval. Now, when I say we want to suggest writing the label first, there's a big movement afoot now of this thing called comparative effectiveness research. And it just strikes horrors in me knowing that, because if you do that, you take not only the two standard deviations of patients you know you can treat from your engineering, your biotoxicity, your clinical studies, and so forth, that you know this population of patients will be fairly safely treated, to the extremes over here of the patients with the most comorbidities. These are the sickest of the sickest. They have the same cardiovascular disease, but to me, they got over into this particular section because, one, they're non-compliant, and two, they have many risk factors, which make them a difficult patient population to treat. So I'm not sure that we should do real-life studies off the bat, because they may not get approval because of this patient population over here that is so sick to begin with. And that may impact on treating the bulk of the patients that could benefit from this particular procedure. CMS is another thorn in our slide now. First of all, we have to ask ourselves, are there established codes for reimbursement? And if not, what would be required for CMS to establish new codes when new technologies are involved? Examples of this are nanotechnology, stem cell research, or new drug delivery systems. This process must start early in overall product development during the pre-IDE phase so that appropriate studies are designed to collect the data required for CMS reimbursement. No reimbursement codes equals no product reimbursement and no products used in patients. So I always say that as goes regulatory affairs, so goes the company. I can't tell you anybody that's more important than regulatory affairs than a company. I even say that in front of them. Makes them feel good. So what does the inventor bring to the process? Well, the inventor provides primarily prototypes for new medical devices. And these prototypes come in all sizes and shapes. We had one inventor who was very prolific, Cesar Gianturco, who started inventing after he retired from radiology at the Carroll Clinic. He came in to Cook and his pockets bulged like he was a little league umpire. He had all kinds of stuff from the hardware store. He pulled off these horses, hoses and valves and things like that. And he said, this is my next idea for a product. And you sit there looking and say, I wonder where this is going. And that was the beginning of one of the primary prototypes. It was then up to us to try and reduce this to good manufacturing and to practice. And oftentimes this is driven by the unmet need of patients. As Michael said, there are many, and there will continue to be many. Identifying the intended patient population to be treated, I think, is extraordinarily important. Subsequent next generation of medical devices to improve function, delivery, safety, and or effectiveness. I think we can't think we can treat all patients in that subgroup or that cohort of patients with cardiovascular disease with the same device. And the devices that may prove benefit to additional patients not studied for the original cohort approval, that is patients with diabetes, renal impairment, challenging anatomy, or new imaging modalities for the original device. Challenging anatomy will start out with a device that requires a certain size femoral artery or femoral vein to be used. And now we have to work, how can we miniaturize this without increasing the safety and effectiveness of the device? So this is very important. And the use of ultrasound is becoming more and more important. There's a big trend now in getting away from ionizing radiation. And Bill Cook said to me one day, he said, Chuck, we can't continue to work only with ionizing radiation. We have to start looking at product development that can use ultrasound to make it much safer for the patient. And some of these endovascular therapies may take you know, an hour or two. That's a lot of radiation. And not only a lot of radiation to the patient, but to the physician and the members of the lab that have to be in that same room. In fact, there was a study published recently that showed the fact that whenever a physician uses the left anterior oblique position of the image intensifier, the essence of glioblastoma goes up significantly. So there are things that we're now having to look at to improve the safety to the healthcare workers as well. What does dentistry bring to the table? Possible early prototype development of medical devices, resources and personnel for the pre-ID requirements. And Cook happens to be blessed with the old Med Institute in West Lafayette, which is now called Cook Research Inc. It's in that building that looks like an F-16 about to take off. Very interesting architectural feat, but a lot of high-powered people in there. Currently, they have about 80 IDE PMA studies underway. Approximately 200 dedicated engineers, regulatory affairs experts, clinical scientists, statisticians, and reimbursement experts. I visited a laboratory or center not too long ago. They had over 100 projects underway. They had one regulatory affairs consultant. Now, you're not going to get to market in a quick way with one regulatory affairs. We have 200 that are working on these 80. And then ongoing relationship with the FDA, which is an ongoing issue. So in conclusion, collaboration between inventors and industry is vital in bringing new medical devices to patients. It's all about the patients. Collaboration is necessary to meet FDA and CMS requirements for U.S. approval and reimbursement. And collaboration is vital in optimizing patient care. Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to ask Laura Lyons to come to the microphone and present her presentation. She is the Vice President of Clinical Quality Regulatory Affairs for Sonomatic, to come up with and share her thoughts with us. Laura is the clinician for Sonar Medical Group, having spent much of her early career as a respiratory therapist in various clinical settings. She has a strong background in all aspects of regulatory quality and FDA relations with comparisons such as the ABL and Roche. She has consulted widely in the industry. It's a pleasure to introduce Laura.
Thank you, Dr. McIntosh. Appreciate that. Yeah. So good morning, everybody, and thanks for being here, and thanks so much for asking me to be here, and special thanks for a few of my friends in the neighborhood. So I love Nora. Everybody probably knows that, but Nora's an amazing person and has helped us so much with BioCrossroads. Sat on the board at SonarMed for quite a while, and still upset she's not on the board anymore, but hopefully you can catch up in a minute. Anyway, I want to say first, before I kind of get into conflicts of interest, so our practice is very different than the ones you've heard about, and had a really different pathway. So the SonarMed product is a product that goes on the end of an endotracheal tube, and it monitors that tube, right? So it's not used as any kind of an implant. But it's really a unique product that, if you look at it, improves patient care. All right? So no reimbursement for this product, but it does mean it's going to get used. But why can it get used? Because it saves the hospital cost. So there are different pathways for a lot of different things. And some of our devices, reimbursement is absolutely critical. You don't have reimbursement, you have no product, and you have no company. But this one was a little different, quite a bit different in many ways. So let's talk about conflict. So let's talk first about the inventor and some of the conflicts I've seen. So first of all, with the inventor of the product is their baby. And very often, the baby's not real pretty to begin with. I mean, I have five kids, and babies aren't always beautiful when they come out of the womb, okay? But they become beautiful people as they grow. And so you've got this conflict with the inventor, with their baby, and what they want it to be. And sometimes they're not able to see all the problems that can come with that. So what goes on with these products as we're building them and growing them, and what can happen? And I've seen it happen where you've got an inventor who is says that they can save the world, and you have other inventors who are afraid to ever let their product go because maybe there's something still wrong with it. Okay? So, but if you look at that conflict, I think one of the most important things I want to say, and I've heard it from the other gentlemen, is that early collaboration with regulatory affairs is really important. And why is that? It's just what you said. It's what's the intended population? Who's going to use this device? But also, what do the clinicians really need to make patient care safer? You know, what's the physician need? What do the therapists need? What do the nurses need? what's needed in the nitty-gritty of that product, okay? And I think you can get some conflicts there, but if you get in early with regulatory affairs, then what happens is a lot of the work that's done by inventors may not have been well documented, so it can't be used for the FDA process. But getting, and this is true for small companies, but even for the big companies, you know, there was always a struggle with R&D and the big companies about when do we bring regulatory. We don't want them involved in our business right now, right? Any of you back in that back row who told me you're from R&D see that struggle? Because I think we're seeing this, the stop sign. Even my CEO sometimes says, oh, that's the sales prevention department over there. But then he sends me out to sell. So, but anyway, early collaboration is really key and important. And a lot of times we wait too long to get regulatory involved. So if you're a big company and you've got the regulatory resources, get them involved in the project sooner rather than later, much sooner than you think you need them. Partner with them because they are your partner, and listen to them and they will listen to you, right? If it's a small company, sometimes you don't have the regulatory expertise, so you do need to bring in a consultant and look for a consultant that can really help you give advice early stage, what to do, how to document things correctly, and get you going in the right direction. So I think that, again, that could be a real conflict about when to bring regulatory in, but I think it's really, really important to think about. Okay, so then I want to talk a little bit about the conflict of the investor. How long does it take to get this done, and how much are you saying this is going to cost? Okay, regulatory work can be expensive. It's not terribly expensive. It can be done in a good fashion, but we're not cheap, are we? And so that expertise comes with a price. And so I think it's really helpful for investors to understand what is the pathway, why is this the pathway, what is it really going to cost me, and how long is it going to take? And it always takes longer than we think it's going to take, right? I mean, rarely do things get done exactly on the time frame that we want. I think that one thing that's important, too, is that, regulatory is not exact science. I think it's as much about the relationship as it is about the regulations. And the regulations may not change a whole lot, but that landscape changes quickly. Sometimes we get changes in regulations and guidance, but the reality is you have to stay abreast of what FDA is wanting and thinking, where their concerns are, and so that kind of an ongoing relationship becomes really important for getting the products to market quickly or getting them to market at all. Now, user requirements. How many of you hear the word user requirements in your work? Okay. So, but why are user requirements even important? Because without the user requirements, we really have no useful product. And again, that's getting regulatory involved early says, okay, so what indeed do we need? What does the user need? Not what do I think is good for the product, but what does the user need? And you cannot have a good product without your user. And these are medical devices, so they all have to be medical input. And I've seen that with some companies, too. Again, early on, you have an inventor, and the inventor sees what his product is. But without that connection to your audience, if you will, to the person who's going to use it, you may not develop the product in the way that anybody wants to buy it. So when you've got physicians involved as inventors, intuitively, you've got all that, and you know the clinical side of it. But if it's an engineer who's involved, they may not see those subtle little things that are really important to the user. And without that, you may end up at the end of the process with a clear product that nobody wants to use. And no investor likes that, right? So, as I said, it takes longer than you expect. So now I'm going to talk just a little bit about the startup. I've been in big companies. I've been in little bitty companies. And with a startup company, it does take longer than you expect, I think. And it's going to cost more money than you think. So one thing that's important is hiring people that can do the job, and that's an expensive proposition a lot of the time. To get a seasoned team in doesn't come at a rock-bottom price, okay? But I think it's really important to spend those dollars and make sure you have people in who know what business is, know the regulatory side, or at least know how to get in touch with people that can help them there, and to spend that money and to spend it early on as you need to get the work done. In a startup company, you can wear lots of different hats. And for me, from day to day, I wear every hat from the quality system. So develop all the procedures, make sure we're doing the right thing, the regulatory affairs, the regulatory compliance, clinical studies, and I'm sales. And there, I mean, I helped move our office. We moved the office. I mean, I brought my grandkids and they swept the floors. So there's a lot of different hats. That can be daunting. It really can, especially if you can't be flexible. But it's also so rewarding. So I have this product. And as, you know, I don't know how I got on this board because I'm a respiratory therapist. This is where I started. I'm not a physician. I love medicine. Maybe I would have been actually a pediatric intensivist in a given time. But it's so rewarding to know that I have a product that can save lives. And to know that I'm part of getting out there and helping the very patients that I used to take care of and really enjoying that. So a startup is difficult. It's daunting. I can remember when I took the job at SonarMed, I also had an offer from Covidian, and my recruiter was like, how in the world would you give up this big company to go with a little bitty company? It's been great, and I've really enjoyed it. And that's really about all I had to say. Okay, I just was wrapping it up with some conflicts. And with that, I want to introduce you to Anantha. So I know Anantha a little bit, actually, from working with him at the CTSI. But let me give you his actual bio. So, and you guys, if you'll come up to the podium, too, as we do it. So Dr. Anantha Shekhar is the founding director of the Indiana Clinical and Translational Science Institute. Okay, it's a statewide institute, and it works with IU, Purdue, and everything. Notre Dame is what I was trying to come up with. Their mission is really to assist with the rapid translation of new discoveries into novel treatments.
Thank you.
And in his role, in addition to that, in addition to leading this statewide translational research, he leads a successful basic and clinical research programs in the areas of stress, anxiety, neuropsychiatric disorders, funded by the NIH, and he's done that since 1989. We should talk about the stress later.
Right. Yeah, that's fine. You don't need to. You don't need to read the whole thing. It's fine.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, so it's been a great discussion. Thank you all, and particularly the panelists and the speakers here now. Just a couple of reflections. As you heard from Dr. Baran, that really innovating as a physician, especially in the surgical fields, it's really a hands-on experience. I mean, we've learned this working with many surgeons within the CTSI and other places, is that they learn as they're doing things and they innovate as they're doing things. And it's very hard to separate that patient care activity from their discovery and their innovation. So when you start thinking about that as, well, you know, he is a surgeon, he wants to promote his own ideas, and he's got total control over patient care, that's a very wrong kind of message that people put out there. And that's been part of the challenge, is how do you create an environment where an innovator actually is innovating while they're treating the patient? And how do you then move that into an actual product that can be practiced by other surgeons, by other practitioners? So you heard a very firsthand experience of a surgeon who's gone through the good, the bad, and the ugly of the entire process, and really made some great difference. So I think that was really very enlightening for me, and hope it was for you as well. And then we heard from Dr. McIntosh about, you know, some of the unique things that at the government level you can do. And I can identify this actually, in fact, now. I'm going to be taking over as the chair of the Board of Governors of the Clinical Center at NIH. So I know the Clinical Center, which is a big 140-bed hospital, research hospital on NIH campus, was formed after Johnson came there and signed that bill, and before the FDA and CMS were there. Now, to do one of those innovative studies at the NIH Clinical Center, it may take a year for you to get the whole study even started, because of the issues of IRB, because of the relationship with the FDA and the NIH and the CMS, and well, of course, they can't even involve CMS because they don't get reimbursed. But those are some of the regulatory burdens that have even landed on the federal innovation centers that have made it very difficult. So I think, you know, this is a very timely discussion, and I'd like to pose a few questions to the panel first, and then open it up for general discussion. So we'll start with Mike. What do you think, Mike, is the single most sort of difficult barrier for a physician, particularly a surgeon innovator?
I think having the time margin to invest in, to free up from patient care to invest in idea development. And then who is your partner to take the idea? Do you develop the entire thing on your own, which is obviously costly from an economic and time perspective? Do you partner with industry? Do you partner with the academic institution? And then what are the barriers to implement that? So I think the time footprint, we're so busy clinically, there's so many things from insurance reimbursement to using the computer, seeing patients, answering the phone, that idea generation requires a ton of margin that we don't have.
So what do you think about this whole issue of conflict, the perceived conflicts and other regulatory pressures on a provider that are really becoming much more onerous?
I think the conflict, I sort of welcome the conversation with patients or other providers. I like to see it accurately presented, what we're developing, what we receive from it, what our relationships are, so that folks can see the full orbed picture. When I see things presented in isolation where I receive $10,000 for XYZ, I think it doesn't differentiate the value of what was developed. Is it generated $1 billion of revenue for industry? Is it a $5 idea? And I think the full disclosure is a much better way to scrutinize the environment.
Yeah.
When patients ask about it, I love it. I love when they say, hey, I heard you designed this implant, or why do you use this implant? And I can explain all the science and the unmet clinical need and the durability. It's really, really great.
I agree. I think that's really great. I have first-hand experience with, I hope there's nobody from IBJ here, but a few months ago they listed all the physicians who received, researchers who received industry funding. And I was the number one listed person, even though almost the entire amount went to IU School of Medicine. Because I'm one of the research officers there, everything is under my name. So it looks like I got millions of dollars from industry. And the irony of the article was this. They said, we're not sure how much he takes home out of this money. So you can see how that could really shade the picture. So Laura, I mean, you had some very great points about how you can engage in a regulatory sort of process right at the beginning, and in that concept, even conflict of interest right at the beginning. Would you say, and your SonarMed company was started with a physician scientist who began that idea. What do you think sort of inspired him, and how do you think you went the route of a startup company as opposed to going with Covidien, selling it to Covidien?
That's a great question. And actually, our inventor is a doctor, but he's a PhD.
Ah,
so he isn't.
Yeah.
Not a medical doctor.
A real doctor, right.
And, and so I think that his invention came when he was at Purdue and he was getting his PhD. And with that, he got a grant from the NIH. So that's really was the genesis of it. He'd done some work early on the neonatal population and got a grant from NIH for his research. And that's really what started the company. And then began little bits of, pulling in a little bit of money here and there. Why didn't he go with a bigger company, I think, is really because the thought and the plan at the beginning was, well, we can get this product where as soon as we get clearance from FDA, we'll just sell the company to a bigger company who would be interested in doing the manufacturing and get it all done. And the thought at the beginning was not even that we'd ever need to really manufacture the product. Okay, so it was just we can just develop it and sell it off. And that might have been a great thought 10 years ago, but it's not a thought anymore. It doesn't really work that way now. And so, with several grants from the NIH, the company was able to continue to go and to move, and he had passion for these babies whose little bitty tubes move around and can come out, and if those tubes come out, they're in a really dangerous spot. So, his passion driven by help from the NIH, really, to say this is a product that could save lives, we need to get it out there, is what started the company.
Yeah, no, that's great. So, Dr. McIntosh, you know, this is an example of where innovators come with ideas, and then sometimes I'm sure they come to Coke all the time with these kinds of ideas. How do you work with those innovators? What kind of things do you help them navigate?
Well, Coke has always been a bit different. We have done very few acquisitions. Bill Cook always said, you know, we've got enough engineers in-house, we have enough people, let's try and develop as many products as possible. And remember, Cook started out 50 years ago with a whole wire guide concept of putting in devices in a non-surgical way. And he used to say to me, Chuck, I'm going to put you out of business someday as a surgeon. And he did, but then he hired me. So it worked out pretty well. And the thing that it's lucky when you live long enough and you've seen the paradigm shift in terms of how we care for patients. It certainly has been for the betterment. And I see these endovascular cases that are done that, as an example, I was at the Arizona Heart Institute one day, and one of the physicians said, do you want to see a complicated thoracoabdominal aneurysm that we're doing? And I said, yes. I said, what time are you going to start tomorrow? I said, no, we're going to do it at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So I walked in the lab, and they had this thoracoabdominal operation done through wire guide technology, and within an hour and a half, they were done. And I said, Grayson, if that were me doing that 20 years ago, I would start at 7 in the morning, and I'd still be mopping up. So it's been very gratifying to me to see the shift in how we treat patients and what it means to patients and getting them back to road to recover again within a couple of days with a knee replacement, what have you. I think the other thing that's been different about Bill, about Cook in general, is that we try to continue to keep the inventor or the innovator involved. We don't just, as I say, we don't do acquisitions. I can't remember the last acquisition that we did. But if we can go ahead and work with the inventor in terms of development of the device, keep them involved through the animal work, some of the laboratory testing, design the clinical protocol, it brings that expertise along. Unfortunately, a lot of inventors say, no, I just want $100 million now, then I'm going to go out of the scene and you can do what you want. We want to keep that inventor involved if we possibly can. And the other thing that was always very obvious to me was that Bill Cook didn't really care whether he made money on a product. And that's why Cook was one of the first, and probably continues to be, one of the first companies that does pediatric device development. And, you know, people would point out to Bill from time to time, Bill, we're not making any money, we don't sell enough. He said, that's not the point. He said, we're serving a need for patients and they need it. You know, we had what was called an interosseous needle, which went into the heel. It was a heavy-duty needle, if you would, that they put into the bone for cardiac fluid resuscitation in a patient that was in shock. And all of a sudden, the FDA wanted us to show what is the effect of putting in the various drugs that are used in resuscitation through that intraosseous needle. And Bill Cook said, they're crazy. He said, you know, why should we worry about it? They were dealing with dead and dying patients. Well, the FDA got involved, and they said, we're going to shut you down. Bill said, come ahead. He said, when you show up on the doorstep tomorrow morning, I'm going to have every television network and radio network on the steps of Cook. And let's see what kind of sympathy you get by shutting Cook down for a product that saves lives in the pediatric population. Guess what? They never showed up. So there are times that Bill would put the gloves on and sort of duke it out with him. And he was right. I mean, I sat on the regulatory panel for 10 years, and I understand the importance in terms of public health safety of some of these devices. I mean, I saw some pretty unusual things being presented to us for IDPMAs. One example was there was a heart valve that had been grandfathered in, and they had done 200 patients for mitral and aortic replacement. And it clearly said they had to have X number of patients for each size of the valves. And sometimes the largest size and smallest size don't work well in these patients. And so we turned them down when I was the chairman of the panel. They came back a year later, almost to the date. They had increased the patient population by 100 in each category, and no adverse event had moved by 1%. So I looked at this fellow from the company, it was a big company, and I said, what am I to think when you've increased your patient population by 100 in each category and not a single adverse event occurred? You just see him sort of slinking down behind the table. And he wasn't approved that time either. So, I mean, there's a real role that the FDA plays, I think, in maintaining patient safety and development, whether it's drugs, biologics, or devices. That's very, very important.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Well, I think, you know, in the interest of time, what I'm going to do is see if there are any questions. I'll open it up to the rest of the audience here, especially for the panel members. This may be a good time to quiz them about some of their material. Yeah.
I'm from the School of Informatics, and so we're lucky that we use the IU Human Subject Office for our IOPs, and you all talked about the importance of partnering with regulatory affairs. And so I don't know how you all approach using an IRB. Is that part of, obviously you probably have to go outside of your company. When do you start that process? I mean, I'm just so lucky that I can pick up the phone. I have a relationship with people in the IRB, so we can do things appropriately. And it's a lot slower than the other things, I agree. But I just want to know how you all do it.
Not at IU, though. We have our IRB approves everything within 4 weeks.
We utilize the Western IRB on a contracted basis, and for the majority of our studies, it's a sort of uniform agreement based on our database that we can pull any data out of the database that we collected prospectively and analyze it in a retrospective fashion. So we have sort of an exemption based on the database agreement for most of our clinical projects that we can pull out of our database. For specific IDE trials, you know, it's a large regulatory IRB process to get that done. So we use the Western IRB, which works okay, but I'll get 10 emails a week that I don't understand what they're talking about. And so
that's because they don't understand what you're talking about.
Right. It's working okay. It's a challenge.
Well, Cook uses, we sometimes use local IRBs, but we've been using a sort of a international or a national IRB recently. And one of the problems is you have to make sure that the makeup of the IRB includes people who understand. And I used to walk into some of our IRB meetings at the NIH and we're presenting a new device. And I'm looking at the faces in that room and there isn't a single person that knew anything about medical devices. We had lots of endocrinologists and oncologists and things like that, but nobody really understood the technology we were talking about. So it was always a long break-in period of you really have to understand what we're trying to accomplish with this particular device. And I think some of the more broad-based IRBs have a broader makeup with their people that do understand medical devices.
And I've used everything from, you know, that hospital's IRB, even smaller hospital's IRB, to a group IRB, I would call it. And I think that part of it is just, again, the communication, understanding what that IRB wants, helping them sometimes when they don't understand what they need, and making sure that there's clear communication with them about what your product is and what you're trying to accomplish and where the risks really are and where the risks aren't.
Yeah.
I think we've made a little different topic, but from a regulatory environment, some products have been approved. Metal-on-metal hip replacement is a recent example that for some products was a total disaster. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of patients around the world have been harmed by device technology that was approved without full orb science or not long enough follow-up, and we're redoing these things all the time. I'm redoing one tomorrow. And so these are important topics to consider. There are some things where there's abundant data that things work very, very well. The combination of device and drug for us is antibiotic bone cement, which has been shown for 30 years to reduce infection extremely well, but we can't get it through the FDA as clinicians to utilize it for routine joint replacement because they can't decide if it's drug or device. And the exact same thing, it is stuck in a regulatory thing. That now we use it off-label. I use it in every patient off-label. I'm sure there's some liability exposure there because there's abundant data that it's clinically relevant. So I see both sides of the FDA's role. We need them, but boy, sometimes we shouldn't get stuck in the bureaucracy for that specific example.
Yeah.
So with the internet and the abundance of information that's available to patients and how that's driving patient interactions with user clinician, how are you managing that? I'm a Cooker Genentech. We're talking about cell regenerative medicine, so we're now stuck with that area and not out of misinformation, not of frankly Charlotte practice out there, how to avoid that to be driven by science.
Yeah, that has taken more of my time than anything else in my. So if someone comes in with the 2-inch printout and they're convinced they know the implant and the surgical approach and what color Band-Aid they want and the whole thing, I make it a very short conversation because, frankly, in our time availability, I'm not going to be able to satisfy their questions, and they sort of need to find another doctor. And so that's a terrible thing. But the misinformation is unbelievable, and people don't come in and ask anymore, hey, what do you think is wrong with my hip? What do you think we should do about it? They say, I'm convinced I need a joint replacement. 9 times out of 10, they don't. So I have to defuse that grenade, and then they say, well, I want this approach and this thing, and I know you're the best because Uncle Fred told me you're the best. It's a very different environment now. So we try and have our own presence on the web for patients to go and read what we want them to read based on science and our approach and so forth. But if you Google hip replacement, you get 412,000 answers, and they're not really accurate. So
do you mind questions from patients?
Oh, love it. Love it.
Okay. Because, you know, we were talking earlier about a personal situation where I thought an anterior hip replacement was going to be better for my sister. And I ended up talking to the physician and asking questions, and he seemed very responsive to that. We didn't do it the way that I had thought.
Yeah.
That hurts better because he was the expert. So
yeah, that's a great conversation. And folks that come in with them written down, you run through the list, that's really great. Hey, I want you to respond to the information that I have. Just as a physician, it never works. It never works. So
we've heard a lot about medical devices in Indiana at previous BioPro Shows event, and you know that we continue to be oftentimes top 5 states for medical devices. You all have come from the medical device industry. So I have a question and then a shameless plug. So I guess my question is, what do you think we need to be doing here in the life science community in the state of Indiana to continue to nurture the startups, particularly? We've got our anchor large device companies, of course, Cook represented. What do you think we need to be doing to encourage physician innovators and to help support medical device startups in a better way in Indiana? And then just a shameless plug, I am co-founder of Pearl Pathway Pearl IRB. We're the only independent commercial IRB in the state of Indiana, and we are accredited. So any of you that can use an independent IRB, please let us get your card at the end as well. Please support an Indiana company
rather than Western IRB.
Sorry. And okay. I also plug IU that has gone in the last 5 years. And as I partner together, the review time has gone up incredibly, thanks to the efforts of PTSI and the things they've done. I think they've done great work there. So, go back to my question about
I think one of the things is to perhaps start a little bit earlier in the process, trying to encourage people to start thinking creatively at the medical student level. Remember, I got yelled at on a valve replacement alarm because I got the sutures mixed up. I was so far away from the operative field, I had no idea what sutures were. I'm sort of standing there like this, hanging on the sutures. So I went home and I said, you know, there has to be a better way to organize the sutures. So I came up with an idea for a moldable suture holder that clipped on the back of a towel clip that had a spring inside of a tube that was variable tension. It had 10 slots, and you could put the sutures in this thing and then hold it up in the air, slide the valve into place, and then cut the sutures in front of the needles, so the needles were passed back on the suture holder to the nurse. But at least three of these would keep the sutures organized. That's when I was at the University of Illinois. By the time I got to the NIH, I showed this to Glenn Morrow, who trained me. He said, I don't want you wasting your time on thinking about things that might be better devices. And I had ideas for coronary perfusor tips and things like that. So a few kind words from Glenn Morrow at that time may have kept me on a different path. So I think encouraging young people to think creatively, to encourage them, to help them along with their ideas and so forth, may be one way that you could enhance that development here in Indiana.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's the exact same thought of med students, residents. We have undergraduates. If they're doing research with us, they spend time in the lab, time in the clinic, time in the operating room. They see the full orb thing of patient care, and I explain the unmet needs, and then they begin to see that you can be a physician innovator. I never had that experience until medical school. And so I think it's the earlier you get to see that and taste of that, the more likely you are to to do, bring ideas, to think, hey, you can do both. You can be in private practice and still be in this space and be a contributing clinician scientist. So I think it's both of those.
Yeah, that was one.
How can medical devices move from a reactive kind of messaging to IBJ articles, for instance, not to throw you under the bus, to more proactive educational? And I know you say you have a website, where you're supposed to testing and messaging early. Dr. McIntosh, you spoke to the importance of the FDA and understanding this from your school. How can the medical device community? Is there a vision or a model?
I'm a little discouraged on the pace of movement in that space. So the two examples that I would use is this partial knee replacement concept. Having trained 3,000 surgeons, there's only like 10,000 of us, so a third of them, I've tried to show them the indications for the procedure, how to do it, the outcomes, walk them through a sawbones, had them watch videos that we've done. The ability to change the direction of the ship, we've made a very small dent in what people think. So that's number one. The ability to actually take these ideas and put them into practice is a huge challenge, even for fairly smart orthopedic surgeons. So orthopedic surgeons, by definition, is strong as an ox and twice as smart. So that's the baseline that we're starting with. The other is outpatient joint replacements. So for 3 years, we've been collecting data on what we're doing and how we're doing it. A friend of mine from Texas called, just opened a center. He's done one hip replacement there in the last 6 months. So he called and said, are you guys really doing this? How many have you done? And I said, well, Dave, we've done 4,000. And he said, really, 4,000? I said, really, 4,000. This isn't 4, it's not 40, it's not 400, it's 4,000. I can show you all the data. He's done two more in the ensuing 3 months. So to move the ship, once it gets going a certain direction in this space, whether it be clinically, device, is very, very difficult. And so I welcome this type of discussion because you guys seem to listen better than some of my peers in this space. It's a challenge.
Yeah. Sorry.
I just have a question. Dr. Barron, you asked about encouraging young people to be creative and about engaging them earlier. I'm at Franklin College, and we have a growing science program. And my friend Brandon back here is from DePaul, so you know we're really looking to get more engaged. I have not talked to other someone because I'm just talking about your research institute and the opportunity to apply there. So how can we become more engaged and connected so that we, in the needs that you're talking about here, in terms of you know your pipeline for human capital.
Yeah, well, I think that it's a two-way street. We're, any of the four of us in our group are happy to come spend a day at Franklin or DePaul. I went to Hanover, so a little bit of bell issues there. But I think we can come share with you what we're doing, sort of like this. We would love to host students in the operating room at any time. I think it's I remember doing that vividly when I was a youth just the other day, and it has a profound impact on your career, on my motivation in school, and things like that. So us visiting, them visiting us, and then I think inviting them to something like this to see what Indiana's doing. I think Indiana is just the greatest state to be doing this type of work that I totally unrecognized when I was choosing the job. So
we're finding our whole scientific curriculum now is about experiential learning, starting as freshmen.
Yeah, we would love that. Obviously, the summer internships are open. The lab stuff is open. We'd love to host anybody any day. Every single day, someone's in our operating room. We have folks from the UK coming next week, and it's just that's how we're moving things forward.
I enjoyed your slide, and I always appreciate that my high school coach always said, have good running shoes.
I think it's important to say that Cook has a number of internships during the summer. And, Steve, I don't know whether RedTech has an internship now or not, but it's an opportunity for people at various levels, prior to or even being early in college, to come in and spend the entire summer with Cook, working at various departments, and it's scattered throughout our various departments at Cook.
Yeah, our program has been active at MedInstitute, where I was formerly, and a lot of the interns are hired on. We find it a great way to bring out great talent.
And I would say, as a small startup company, it's really hard to, for us to take the time to come to you guys and say, hey, we need summer interns. So, you know, finding those, but we do use summer interns, and we, because we're small, we can give them a great look at what the industry really is. And so it's probably helpful for you guys to reach out to the smaller companies and say, hey, do you have opportunities? There we go. Okay.
That's great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So this has been a great discussion, fantastic panel, great talks. So appreciate all of you taking your time on a beautiful day like this, spending a couple hours here. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.